Good evening, darlings, and welcome back to the second hour of Radio Alchemy on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. Something's happening with Roy of Hollywood, and isn't that a good thing? All right. So, in this hour, we are back for the second in a very extended long series in talking about media ecology and talking about media and its extensions and how we are fish in a sea of electromagnetic energy, in energy that maybe we just don't even know about. We don't recognize because it's so similar to what we have naturally going on in our bodies. And the man to turn to talk about such high concepts of being fish in soup and the creation of our own matrix, unbeknownst to us, is Bob Dobbs. We're reaching him in New York. And what we're going to be discussing tonight is a paper written by David Cook on Paul Virilio's The Politics of Real Time. It's really absolutely fantastic mind bender. And I think that's why you stay up late, darlings. It's because you want to get bent. You know that there's something else going on in this world. You know that there has to be, or because it just can't be this sick on a normal day. So let me, for one, have Bob say hi to everybody out here and get into the heads of everyone in the lovely footprint of KPFK. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Hello, Eben, and everyone. Thanks for coming back. It's been a month, and I'm ready for class two.
All right. Here we go with class two. All right. So this is from the article, The Politics of Real Time by Paul Virilio. And I just want to read a couple of paragraphs to kind of give you an idea of what we'll be discussing. And heck, how do we know what we're going to be discussing? Because this is quite a brain twister, but it is very fun. And I'm sure Bob will twist it up and unknot it for us all at the same time.
Yes.
The primordial geometry, with its sense of space and time as a lived experience or social practice, did not last long, for it gave rise to what we normally take for geometry or to what Husserl refers in his reference to ideal objects. Here is how Virilio describes it. And, in effect, our civilization begins at the moment where the Greeks exhumed geometry from their ethnological field, where they tear it from the social practice in distinguishing the properties of forms of dimensions from their representations. They did not invent geometry, but the ecological utopia. In making it independent of the places and times of societies, they made geometry a power in itself, that which these societies would have to imagine for themselves in recreating with their relations to space their relations to nature. And it is this type of liberating conviction that animates all ancient thought right up to the impossible mathematics. Here is a refrain, and this is David Cook now, here is a refrain that will appear countless times in Virilio's work, that the sense of time and space has been torn from its field in what amounts to annihilating moment, a moment of no space, of utopia, or more precisely, a denial of time and space. The common, as the ground of the social, disappears, becomes invisible. We are then sent on our long history of abstraction and negation that plays itself out, as we shall see later, in his suicidal state. That is David Cook talking about Paul Virilio, The Politics of Real Time. Start out, Bob, by telling us why an article about Paul Virilio is important in understanding media ecology.
Well, McLuhan had a big effect on, that's Marshall McLuhan, 1911 to 1980. He was taken up very seriously in France in the late 60s, partly because the World's Fair was held in Montreal in 1967, and there was a rising separatist mood in Quebec. General de Gaulle, the head of France, came over in 1967 and said, Viva Quebec, and he accused certain people of being involved in the Kennedy assassination. This was,
do you accuse them of what?
He accused certain Americans of being involved in the Kennedy assassination. He got carried away over there in Montreal, Quebec,
oh.
with the idea of retrieving his colony. And he just took shots at everybody. But the big thing was he said, Viva Quebec, not Viva Canada. So the fact that McLuhan, the World's Fair was McLuhan's fair, and at Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media, McLuhan's books were being released in 67, created an unforeseen effect, leading to people like Jean Baudrillard, Jacques Derrida, Paul Virilio, Deleuze and Guattari, all these people that your peers would have studied in the social sciences or in literary classes in the 80s and 90s were people grappling with the effect of McLuhan. As a matter of fact, the French dictionary has the word McLuhanisme. It made McLuhanism a word.
Mm-hmm.
So Virilio was one of the people, along with Roland Barthes, who met McLuhan. And Virilio, his main point, now I'm going to explain Virilio in the context of McLuhan, but David Cook, a colleague of Arthur Croker and a professor at the University of Toronto, gives us the normal concepts that leads us to how McLuhan fits in this. So what you just read was the effect of abstract geometry, not primordial geometry that the Greeks created. Now we know McLuhan said the abstract geometry of Euclid came out of the effect of the phonetic alphabet. So what Virilio is doing, and Virilio is a man who will not enter a plane. He will not fly anywhere, all right?
Hmm.
He is a little upset with speed, and we're going to work towards speed in a minute.
Okay.
The abstraction of the Greek geometry from primordial geometry means that the primordial geometry was located in local villages, tribes, areas. It was not phoneticized. Phoneticized alphabets allowed Alexander the Great to move across and absorb and translate local dialects, local languages, and written iconographic languages into a standardized phonetic alphabet. That is the utopia of absolute visual abstract space, a mental space that Plato idealized that Virilio is talking about.
Now, are you saying then that the idealized space is without the phonetic alphabet, correct? It is a space where the experience of primordial geometry is it is as close to nature and the natural characteristics of nature that Homo sapiens experienced on a very literal basis? Is that...
No, the idealized space is the phoneticized space, what Virilio is complaining about.
What he's complaining about?
Yes, he is. The primordial geometry is one localized in speech, in number and rhythm. It is still within the effect of writing, but it's iconographic, syllabaric and pictographic writing. It's
right.
The abstract, ideal translation that the phonetic alphabet can do to any particular local language and geometry. So think of Egyptian hieroglyphics, to make it simple, and then think of Euclidean geometry. The space of Euclidean geometry was a result of the phonetic alphabet. That's idealized space. Virilio sees this as the fall of Western man, because it's that utopia of an ideal space that the state starts to claim to act in the name of. All right?
Okay. I think I have that. And so when you were saying that it was Peter the Great that was able to consume the identities, let's say, of these landlocked people, or you know, of these different cultures.
Yeah, the means. Now, it was Alexander the Great. The means.
Oh, I'm sorry, Alexander the Great. Right.
To keep their writings local, it was the standardization of the phonetic alphabet, the abstraction of the vowels from the consonants, to speak technically, that allowed him to absorb and dominate the local communication systems. That whole effect is an ideal space that Virilio is complaining about, and set up the idea of a state with centers and margins extending over horizontally long distance. It was the beginning of spatial empires. All right?
Very good. Okay.
Okay, do you want to go to the next quote, or do you want me to carry on?
No, carry on. I want you to carry on.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting about you're reading David Cook's interpretation of Virilio.
Right.
But let's just lay out what Virilio did with a quote like that. Virilio took the fact that the space and time had disappeared in the 60s and 70s. He got that from McLuhan. But he decided to emphasize kinetic space, or the vectors of speed. Think of your moving kinetic space as the movement of your body, running in that.
Okay.
He saw that once the state was set up in an ideal utopia caused by the phonetic alphabet, wiping out primordial or local geometry, creating this idealized geometry 2,000 years ago, that it was then that real war, that war was guided really to develop vectors of speed. It didn't matter about the conquering of local people. Technology now was on an evolution that was geared toward increasing speed. So he moves this, he studies the militaries of the last 15 or 2,000 years, and then he sees the Industrial Revolution as not a revolution of increased liberty where people can move about. He sees the moving about imposed by the French Revolution, the American Revolution, as a dictatorship of movement itself by the military. Now we can move that up forward to understand 200 years later, we have the dictatorship of highways and airports, airplanes, and these means of movement that nobody can bypass. The societies are conditioned by them. So these kinetic vectors really are increased with the Industrial Revolution. And as I say this stuff, knowing the other kinds of guests you have, let's think of what I'm talking about, this new industrial geometry, compared to the romanticizing of sacred geometry,
yes,
or New Age geometry,
right,
which are really naive projections of the abstract effect of the phonetic alphabet, totally ignoring or romanticizing but not getting the rhythm of the primordial geometry which came out of oral societies.
Can we go back just a ways back, Bob? When we're talking about geometry, everybody has a conception. You know, we're talking about shapes.
In the mind's eye. In the mind's eye.
And that is the primordial. That's the virtual or the.
That's the beginning of virtual space or the ideal utopia space that the phonetic alphabet created. The geometry before that is a rhythmic, cyclic, numerical chanting geometry, primordial, rooted in local place. It's not as abstract as the Western phonetic geometry.
How does something that is movement, that is chanting, actually have forms?
It doesn't have visual. It does have sculpture. For example, what are the pyramids? The pyramids are the shaping of vast spaces of rhythmic energies tied in with astrology and the rhythms of the cosmos, which preliterate man felt as part of himself when he or she thought they had to bring the sun up, right? They had to drag it up. It was part of their body organs, an expanded version of the body organs, not limited to the organs inside the envelope of skin. You know, the idea we have a body with skin as the outer boundary,
yes,
that came in with the phonetic alphabet. Before that, there were no boundaries. The whole natural fabric you lived in was what you pulsed with. And so as you moved into the writing societies, and even before the phonetic alphabet, and imagine the most primitive societies and the pulsing that Terence McKenna talks about, the utopia of plant involvement with vegetation, in that tactile phase and on the way to pinpoint abstract visual space, you would have a huge sculptured space, which is indicated by the pyramids. The pyramids are primitive geometry.
Yes.
All right, that are resonating with huge spaces. Now, compare that to a little guy, Euclid, writing little charts and circles on a piece of paper.
Yes.
All right?
Right.
But yet that piece of paper was bigger in its effect and in novelty than the spaces of the pyramids. So I'm trying to show you the geometry was tactile and sculptural and oral before writing. And that is the kind of geometry Virilio romanticizes.
And the reason why Euclidean geometry had a larger impact is because, in a sense, it was mobile compared to a fixed.
Exactly. The vector path, the kinetic vector came in. You could move across space. When the previous dynasties just wanted to dominate time, then they didn't have to worry about space.
Oh.
But once the space was fragmented into this abstract space, then you had to fill it up by moving about inside it.
So you're talking about, on a very simplistic level, you're talking about navigation. You're talking about the ways that they actually have conquered and traced the world because of this abstract thought allowing them to take over space.
Right. Thought and abstract medium, the effect of the written papyrus. Now, imagine that with the printing press. It gets increased even more 2,000 years later, and it leads to the Industrial Revolution, where Napoleon and these people... The real war was not in in conquering and owning territory. It was developing technology that allowed you to move faster so that cities and the mercantile system become way stations, just stopping points in your increasing desire to speed up. So speed is the medium that Virilio isolates from McLuhan's thinking. And the particular sense that he uses is kinetic sense. Is the kinetic sense, and then the world of kinesics. Now, he then gets into, when the electric age comes in, the freezing of the proletariat and the Industrial Revolution into having to move about and not being able to sit still, which was seen as progress. Virilio sees was the hidden trap, because then everybody was locked into cities and industrial factories, with speed a sign of progress. But then the time of total war came in the electric age with the World War I, where space disappeared and the world imploded and you were in a world of time. But the increments of time were being superseded by faster and faster technologies. The climax of that is nuclear bomb. And then you move into this virtual reality, which is, Virilio emphasizes, is speed-based, to the point we have instantaneous enclosure. So that Virilio says, we fear a nuclear war or war that will annihilate us. He says, we've been annihilated already by the vectors of increasing instantaneous speed. And that was the real meaning of the military.
Now, in the beginning of the article, David Cook says, the one constant in the 20th century was the speed of light. And later goes on to say, light ushers in a globalization of the virtual. At what point could you say that the ground or the natural or the proto natural settings that we are actually disappeared if light is a constant was still a factor of time? Because if they can, like you were saying, they thought they need to bring up the sun. And am I looking at light in two different ways? But I'm just wondering how
Yeah, you're
that,
looking
how
at light with your eyes. The light of Einstein is an environment. It's not just what you see. It's the speed of sensation. It's the light of ESP. It's interesting that as we moved into the main medium of instant light, television, that people got interested in the Tibetan Book of the Dead and moving through stages of light and the clear white light and the stages of death, which was like retrieving an old culture that manifested the disappearance of space and time and our bodies into an instantaneity. The only image we could think of is light. So Einstein was showing the electric effect and using the term light, the speed of light.
Okay.
Now, Virilio sees the speed of light. Later in the article, I think you've read it all, doesn't he go on to critique Einstein and finds Einstein a dupe of the vector move kinetic instantaneity that the military is all for?
Well, I think I read that but didn't understand it.
Right, but you might get it now this time, right?
Right, yes.
With this background. So the important thing is that the Iraqi war... A war of bombing cities and that is not the war that is wiping us out. It's the war of instantaneity. That is Virilio's point, which was a point that Joyce made in Finnegan's Wake. He wrote all his book on one page, and then he repeated the page 627 times, with each page showing variations like a kaleidoscope of the instantaneity of Einstein. Joyce was critiquing Einstein in Finnegan's Wake. McLuhan figured that out. And then you can't really go past McLuhan in terms of the way he sums it all up. So Virilio takes the kinetic factor. he will move towards the tactile factor, which is what Einstein's theory really visualizes, and he will show the effect of the kinetic space and its extensions starting from the time of the Greeks and creating an abstract geometry that needed to be filled in that was the unconscious motivator for the state. You hear about the radicals and the anarchists talk about the state. Well, the state is this ideal space, this ideal utopia. And that image motivated everybody until you got into the Industrial Revolution and then the 20th century, where space did not matter anymore, only time. And then the technology got so involved that the military, the threat was that if I attack you, you can attack me immediately back. So the idea of attacking somebody became obsolete.
Right.
And a side thing is that's where the AIDS virus came from, the obsolescence of spatial destruction. But that's a story for another time. I just put that teaser in. But the point that Virilio says is that speed is the real war. It's the last war and removes us from all physical locality and dimensions. So if you can you go to a later quote in the essay to see if it's something that we can that approximates what I'm saying now, because we began with the first quote, which was, 2,000 years ago.
Yes, yes, absolutely. How do you feel that David Cook, while I'm looking for this, says that because of the retention of Christianity in Virilio's ontological considerations, that it makes his metaphysics more theo-ontology. Why, in a sense, how would religion and Christianity necessarily play into the idea of speed?
Right. Now, David Cook and Arthur Croker are very appreciative of Virilio's insights, but they question his reliance, the fact that he personally is a Christian and uses Christian ideology as a political defense. I don't know what religion Croker and Cook are, but they're not going to be involved with Christianity. So they technically say, how can we explain Virilio's fall back to Christianity? And this is what this whole essay is about, is that they're saying Virilio has a romantic version, an earlier pre-Roman Catholic Church state-oriented religion of Christianity. They see Virilio as a curious pagan Christian, who idealizes the primordial geometry. Notice he still has to have geometry, which is written and eye-based, and that is where mysticism comes from, the eye-based, especially in the West. So he still holds on to the eye, or space and time, but he sees it with an oral, sculptural, tactile dimension. He sees that as the real Christian strategy, the Christian anti-environment, to this realm of speed that comes out of the ideal geometry or the eye. So he's a non-eye Christian, all right?
Yes.
So that is what Cook is taking on, the visual bias, the final incipient visual bias of Virilio. And in the end shows how Virilio cannot really see what's happening, even though his insights are very necessary to understand. So what you have in that essay is a psychiatric analysis of the way Virilio deals with the disappearance of us, right?
Yes.
And he props up you see, the thing about Virilio, he's often seen, he was part of all the left or new left or radical movements. He was on the street fighting up with the right wingers, fighting against them. Yet he's a Christian. So David Cook is trying to figure out why Virilio has that quirk, yet it turned out, and David Cook in this article seems to say something about Virilio no one understood, he realized that the space and time dialectic in Virilio was based on this ideal geometry, and that was the Achilles heel of Virilio. What Cook doesn't say, and I said to him privately, is that that is McLuhan's larger means of critique that Virilio is an extension of. McLuhan could be accused, since he went to church every day, of the same kind of romanticized Christianity as Virilio is. But no, McLuhan is more aware of the phonetic alphabet as an effect on the creation of geometry than Virilio is.
Well, so within the conception, within the whole linguistics of this kind of dialogue, how would McLuhan talk about Christ or Christianity in terms of you know, light geometry, of being close to ground?
Right. McLuhan considered the image of light as non-Christian. He saw the printing press as enhancing the image of the light, leading to what he called the Puritan left-wingers, the pilgrims, the Oliver Cromwellites, people addicted to the printed book. And they had an idea of the light of purity, of the divine light of inspiration, was totally a product, a reflex of the printed book. And McLuhan did not embed himself in favor of any medium. All right. Virilio still imagines, sacralizes the geometry, primordial and non-visual as it is. McLuhan was the absolute most modern yogi because he didn't identify with any particular medium. So he saw light as the bias that led to Gnosticism, that was the ground and influencing image in all the arts and sciences of the last 300 years. There was the secret society, the agents of the light. Now, you can see in the New Age that this worshiping of the light, I mean, most all religions have the light emphasized in some form or not.
Very true.
Maybe one religion that doesn't is Zen Buddhism. It talks about the void.
Right.
But it's a pulsating void. And McLuhan said they were the most insightful into tactility. And if anything, any sense is McLuhan's sacred sense is tactility. But remember, he defined tactility as not a particular sense, but the thing that, or the consciousness that organizes the input of all the other five senses.
You know, that you brought up senses. It talks about Ceres' reflection on origins of geometry, where the five senses form basis for early mathematics. What is it about, how is it the five senses relate to something, geometry, which is supposed to be an idealized form?
Right. Now, people ask me about why do you emphasize the numbers 22, 18, 14, and 7 and 8? What's this number stuff? Well, in occult lore that I get from the other plane through the Evergreens, there was the great mathematic. The great mathematique, or the great mathematic, was what aliens gave us 10,000 years ago. And it was that understanding of the rhythms of the cosmos and the numbers of it that helped build the pyramids. Now, I'm digressing here to come back to a point. If you didn't have any means of visualizing, you'd be in the bog of speech, orality, and rhythm and touch, tactile space. If you begin to see and organize, what would be the first symbol? The first symbol would be a visual image of rhythm, because you'd be so involved rhythmically in a tactile society and an early primitive oral society, speech-driven society, that if you actually tried to focus on one image, it would have to be an image that reflects rhythm. So math, numbers, were the first visualization out of the tactile mud. All right? So it later becomes alphabetized into algebra and geometry. So as we move back into the tactile mud in the 20th century, the post-space and time rhythmic world that we experience now constantly, then numbers would come back as with archetypal intensity. So in the American culture in the 50s, you had the Heinz 57. You had the 7-Eleven. You have a lot of numbers in corporate logos.
Philip 66.
Beg your pardon?
Philip 66.
Yes. Route 66.
Right.
the use of language as a pop folk culture milieu, as something that everybody could say and use, like an Esperanto, was the effect of us moving into the tactile TV environment. So your question was about how can math, which is visual, relate to, what was the quote?
The five senses.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the five senses, if you even began to enumerate and categorize five senses, you're beginning to tend toward the eye, and early writing would separate out these functions. You see that you're moving out of the non-visual tactile zone, so the five just enumerating the five senses would have a rhythmic mathematical base. So yes, we first talk about mathematics as this abstract space, what he called, Virilio called geometry, but it is not the primordial geometry, which Virilio was looking for, which is further back, but not tactile. McLuhan worked from the tactile position. Another way to imagine tactility is it's pure ESP. In this sense, there is rapidity of communication beyond any visual notions of sequentiality or cause and effect. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, when you were saying that at the primordial level there is rhythm, and then from there you can that can arrive at some kind of graphic representation,
right.
Virtual representation. I'm wondering how it became a closed system of shapes if that is a linear procedure. Rhythm just keeps going and going and going. Or do people then reflect upon it that their rhythms are repetitive, and so that makes it a closed system? I'm done with that rhythm. I'm starting a new one.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because now you can see when the Phoenicians, say 1000 BC, were traveling around the Mediterranean and trading, they had to keep track of their trading. So they created numbers, early accounting books. And you know, that abstract use of writing for a practical new means of trade was led to the phonetic alphabet via the Semitic writing, the Hebrews writing. So the abstraction, the moving over space by ships and navigation, was a way of not being local anymore. So it's interesting, the Phoenicians, well-known traders, were able to develop this beginning of writing on a technical, practical, abstract way. It was not completed until the Greeks created the phonetic alphabets, which removed the vowels away from the consonants. So the abstraction goes on for thousands of years, from that early pyramidical sculptural rhythms through the Aryan races, racing the Aryan tribes from the north, racing over steppes on horses. The horse helps to create an emphasis on the eye, because you're moving over vast spaces rapidly. You're not hanging out in a little zone.
Right.
You know, and staying in a place. You could see the migrant of the hunter and gathering societies. They'd be tactile and visual. Then you get the agriculture. They'd be tactile and non-visual. Then the agricultural society starts to sedentarize, and they become sedentary, and then they might look at the stars and look at rhythms, and then they get local signatures, forms of writing. But then the horse comes along and it moves over space more rapidly and knocks out the agricultural societies.
Right.
And then you get the wheel, and the wheel is the beginning of Western civilization and the eye. Constantly see the speed vector?
Yes.
An important point about the McLuhan's knowledge is to understand that the eye is intimately linked with the kinetic, moving over space, kinetic vectors.
Interesting.
And that's a larger picture that Virilio sort of takes as a subtext and develops by studying all the changes in the military and seeing the common denominator was not the goal of occupying territory to preserve it and save it, but was to move across the globe and make all stopping points just temporary and move toward instant speed. That was the subconscious dynamic of the state and the military. So you see how math comes into early visualization and then goes through different cultures for hundreds of years and then crystallizes with the Greeks. But the Romans were the only ones who had papyrus and its flexibility and roads, kinetic vectors there, to bypass Alexander the Great's dreams.
Interesting. Let me remind folks, this is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and you are tuned to Radio Alchemy. I'm your host, Eben Ray. On the line, Bob Dobbs. We are talking about, we are getting a history lesson from a perspective that I think very few of us have been able to dip into. And so it's fantastic to be in class two with Bob on the origins of media and the origins of ground and all of us disappearing. And
right. I want to say, Eben,
yeah.
That this I'm not engaging in linguistic concepts. I am trying to point to our senses and how media came from our bodies. So it's grounded in what we all experience empirically.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
I'm not coming up with a word game here. It may sound like it because I'm covering vast spaces of time, but the idea is to get people to see what is around us and how it's a perfect reflection of the evolution of our bodies.
Right. So here I've gone to page 21. This is a 28-page essay, you guys. And you can find it at www.ctheory.net. And you can go and do a search for David Cook or Paul Virilio. And Virilio is V-I-R-I-L-I-O and Paul. And you can look at this very fascinating, fascinating text. And so let me
see. It's like a hologram. In a sense, you touch on one point and it resonates all over.
Right.
The thing today is that the greater, the better the thinker, that you jump into that person, you're always in the middle. So we can show you the most advanced text. It'll always radiate back to his original themes and to his future themes. And so when you read David Cook, you have no idea who he's talking about, but you are stuck in the middle. That's our technological condition. We're all stuck in the middle with one interface.
Hmm. But the brilliance, I guess, of that too is that once you get a clue, you get to see the whole thing.
Yeah,
because it's in a sense interconnected in that way, right?
Right. But note your words: see the whole thing. I would say you feel
the
whole rhythm.
Right, the rhythm.
Because if you just see it, you haven't got out of the 19th century.
Okay. Oh, so, well, that's interesting. Because when you're talking about feelings, that does use all of your senses, but on an internalized virtual basis.
Right, and that's been externalized.
Right.
That ability.
That ability's been externalized. Yes, go ahead, sir.
So we have cloned ESP. Our modern century has cloned the ESP tactile condition. That's what we're moving towards to understand. I just sent you the Virilio essay as a point in the middle to begin to crawl our way out.
Right. Let me ask this. This is kind of a tangent.
What was the quote on? You're going to do a quote on page 21, or are we going to do something else?
Oh, I was going to do a tangent real quick.
Okay.
Okay. Because you were talking about the externalized senses, et cetera. Is there supposed to be, if you had to say or come up with the new defining ideology for why Homo sapiens are on this planet? Because I've gone to these conferences, nanotech, biotech, IT tech convergence, and the idea is that they are looking at this amazing externalized technology of nanotechnology was basically to enhance creature comforts. Let's see, you want to learn Russian in a day? We'll put this chip in your head and you can do that. You want to run faster? You know, it's like cosmetic surgery at a very, very high level, besides, of course, whatever health benefits. But I was struck that they didn't have a further conception of what Homo sapiens are or could be, and that they're using this technology to make better caves and to make, just creature, enhance creature comforts. In knowing what you know about externalized media, body and media, what is a new conception for Homo sapiens and why we're here, or what we can do differently to quit being the gerbils on the industrial pinwheel?
Right. The reason these nanocosmetics on our inner and external parts are so obsessive as a fascinating image and an idea of progress is that the body has disappeared. The body is limed, controlled by an outer skin, like an envelope. The Greeks brought in the idea of the body as a skin, the skin as an envelope. And then that carried through, and in the Dark Ages, they went into non-visual metaphors because they didn't have papyrus to hold the society together, and the Greek image disappeared a bit. But when the printing press came in, then a new image of the body was the image of a pumping machine. You look at the image, think of Da Vinci and his interest in hydraulics. They started to begin to emphasize the kinetic space, the kinetic sense, and the eye, and developed kinesics. And the new body image was the idea of these inner organs pumping, all right? The organs and humors. Then when you get in the industrial age, the body image changes. It becomes a bag of chemicals loaded with germs. When television came in, you have, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, an interest in chakras and occult imagery or other cultures' images of the body. These became quite accepted in the 80s and 90s, but it was contrary to the I.G. Farben image of the body, which was came out of the 19th century bag of chemicals with statistics laid over it about you need this, that protein, this kind of blood, and all that stuff. The mapping of the mechanical eye on the body has weakened over the last 50 years. So even when you get into computer technology, which leads to a hologramic existence, an interesting medical body image that's retrieved because of that is acupuncture, where you touch one meridian, you know, and penetrate one meridian, and it affects all the rest of the body.
Yes.
I think with herbs, the reason they're popular as a new adjunct to a body image, the body image that they deal with is that something you take affects your auras. And all this like tactile meridian imploding spherical situation around you, outside of your skin envelope. Most of the new alternative medicine is meeting a need that our skin envelope is not what we're limited by. It's not our image. So that's an example of new technologies change our image. The environments new technologies create change our body image and our body percept. The old American Medical Association can't keep up with these changes, so they just became robots of dumping drugs in you as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. They're still limited by the bag of chemicals idea. Mm-hmm. Now, the nanotechnology...
That's how they make money.
Right. Well, I don't think they make money. Nobody makes money anymore.
Oh, I didn't mean to take you on the tangent there. Okay.
Yeah. No, nobody makes money anymore. Money is just circulation. Reality is just circulation for these... extensions of ourselves. Where flesh is the question. Where is flesh in the middle of this? But the nanotechnology is taking the old parts of the body and, as you say, improving it for certain particular functions. Though that's the old image becoming an art form, an obsessive rearview mirror image. So they're applying nanotechnology to I.G. Farben's body parts. All right? What was one of your examples? Cosmetics, but it was
like if you want to run faster,
right? Taking your legs, and the scientists who were, isn't it Eric Davis? Eric somebody wrote the book on nanotechnology.
Yes, Eric Davis.
Yeah, I don't know if it's Dreyer or something, but anyways, yeah, that guy, he is romanticizing what the miniaturization of nanotechnology will do for our old body image. And he has no inkling that when nanotechnology becomes an environment, it will create a different body image.
Right.
And people won't even want to go faster. There'll be the year 2525 with your arms and legs hanging by your side. You know, what is the body image in that famous song from 1969, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the year 2525. You ever heard that?
Yeah.
So the thing is that the naivety of the technologists, they are unconsciously working within the present, even though they have these fantastic images of potentials in the future. Their image of the present is caused by old technologies.
Yes.
Like, let's take this new thing and apply it to an old body. How is nanotechnology going to affect my auras? Is it going to make me see telekinesis better? I don't hear them talking about that. But a lot of people think they got auras now and that they have chakras, right? Which is what happens when you extend tactility through television. The instant ESP of television, its instant extension of tactility, knocks down the walls of the old Greek body, or the body of the Renaissance, the pumping factory, or the body of the bag of chemicals loaded with germs.
So, okay. So if they are just being reflects or regurgitating old and dressing up old technologies,
While creating new technologies, which will have fantastic effects in the image of the body that they don't even foresee.
So where is the new conception of, because they are reacting to a historical basis of just understanding Homo sapiens as pleasure seekers, worker bees, part of, the economic system of this world, et cetera, things to control and oppress, whatever they understand, what the history of Homo sapiens has been on this planet. What are they missing? Where would nanotech be if they had the perception that you have?
Nanotech would be put on hold temporarily and realize that everything that they imagined nanotech would do has already happened to us. We can run faster with the telephone, run faster with the cell phone. We are photons of energy now. An example of the body image changing is most people, the new term for alternative medicine is energy medicine. I want energy. Now, the alternative way is to take vitamins, supplements, herbs, whatever, whereas the regular way, the allopathic way, is to just take a drug to get energy. But the reason both forms of energy medicine arrive is that we live by getting a hit of energy, way more powerful than heroin or junk. Because when you turn on TV or turn on the radio or turn on the internet, you are putting on the whole universe, and you are just zooming paradoxically in all directions in a state of ESP. So
Bob, is that a good thing? Or I don't understand. Is that good? I mean, this is the way it is. I understand that. But that we have, and that you're trying to educate us on the extensions of our first nature senses, should we do something different? Or should we just come to, are you trying to have us understand that this is the way it is, and there you have it, you've disappeared? Or is there supposed to be something, are we supposed to learn something to do something different with our trajectory?
Yeah, I think if there's not an understanding of how cold it is or how hot it is, you're just reacting to the climate. So I'm describing the present climate. If you imagine it got really hot right where you are now, and you don't understand why you feel hot, and you're running around grabbing at anything to somehow assuage this heat, and you don't have the simple understanding of where it's coming from, then you can think of identity crises, wars, violence, extra sports activity, everything that we witness in the entertainment world as a frantic attempt to cover up or to warm ourselves, or to drop the clothes off because the climate, because our house is on fire and we don't recognize what's causing it.
Very good.
So if just one person understands me, we save that person at least for a little longer. But the thing is, the collective means of understanding this is what is at hand now. Everybody is looking for the answer or the particular solution, where the solution is in the problem. We have instant ESP. We have entered the world of silence. Yet that's why we have so much noise in all forms of media. Extravagance and Baroque spirals of creativity. Creativity is obsolete today. If you're interested in understanding why people are energized with no relief in sight. Now, if this is what's happening and the collective psychiatry cannot be achieved, the collective understanding, then one-on-one, if you hear me, you might get it. But collectively, we're in a state of chaos, and I wouldn't judge it, whether it's good or bad.
Okay.
But since we have time to use an old technology like a radio to spell out how we got this fire going, then let's, while we have the time, say it.
Yes.
But humans never knew why the sun was coming up, why it rained, or anything. We've never understood anything about our real bigger habitat that we live in. We've developed patterns about it, and that's created great cultural artifacts, but we're still inside a mystery experience. So to say something's good or bad is not relevant. What is relevant is to describe what we thought we were doing, what we think we have to do in relation to what is the present.
But Virilio is making a judgment about the introduction of geometry into a virtual scale. He's saying that's wrong. He is making a good or bad judgment on that.
Right. That's why he dilutes McLuhan. He dilutes the insights of Finnegan's Wake into a particular bias, which is okay. He's in the mix. He may be faking it all. He's just putting on that strategy as an anti-environment.
Okay.
And he personally has no real identification with what he's saying, but we're all public beings, and we have to put on a public role, generally, a statement of either pro or con in relation to what's happening,
yes,
or of lukewarmness. So I don't know really what his motive is, but on the apparent surface, yes, he's biased. He's
okay.
not understanding the tactility. And that's what I liked about David Cook's article, is he found a way to critique and put Virilio in his place. Because Virilio is what recognized as a great thinker, supposedly, at this point.
Let me tell folks, this is KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara County, and you are tuned to Radio Alchemy. I'm your host, Eben Ray. On the line, Bob Dobbs, reaching him in New York. He is a McLuhan scholar, insider, extraordinaire, and he is joining us every third week of the month to give us a class on media ecology. And we're talking about an article by David Cook on Paul Virilio, The Politics of Real Time. And
now let's go into real time.
Okay, we only have 4 minutes left, so it's going to be like an introduction, darling.
Right. If you found the quote on page 21 that you wanted to read.
Well, that was in response to him attacking Einstein's theory on space, on his I think this might be the quote. Let me see if this is within the ballpark. Einstein's equation is generally presented in terms of energy juxtaposed to the speed of light and mass, but quite naturally it can be expressed with either mass or light on the left-hand side. This is precisely the logic of Virilio's case. Take the commutation m equals nc squared. Here, matter, mass, is converted in the waveform, and the hard world gives way to the virtual. This is Virilio. The matter-time of the hard geophysical reality of places gives way to the slim light time of a virtual reality, which modifies the very truth of the durée, thereby provoking, with the time accident, the acceleration of all reality, of things, living beings, social cultural phenomenon. I don't necessarily, maybe that's not the quote where he takes on Einstein.
No, that's good enough.
Yeah.
The point is that Virilio himself, who wanted to get back to time as opposed to space, has to confront the fact that there is a what he calls real time, which is non-time, which is the tetrad managers using the military, engaging in visual instantaneity that dislocates any sense of duration, no matter how short. So real time is Virilio's term for the instant world we live in today, which is a disappeared world as far as our bodies are concerned, or we're disappeared in relation to it. So real time is I would sum up as the phrase, the creation of the present as an art form, since there's not a present for us. So what does that mean for all older media that describe a present in relation to a past or in a future or to a future? Illusory things. So wealth comes out of the past. We're selling older media to keep assuaging and massaging ourselves from the mute, deaf response we have to real time, which disappears us. And I come back, the only way out of this is new energy based on new hardware, which would be cold fusion, zero-point energies, is the only way to get out of this software tyranny.
Cold fusion as the way to get out of the software tyranny. In the last couple of minutes, wouldn't the idea of cold fusion still just bring up as a new technology a new form of war?
No, because you'd be able to have your shelter and warmth taken care of and your power needs, which are the original problems for humans, like how to stay warm, how to have shelter. We have TV doesn't give you shelter. Telephone doesn't give you shelter. It helps you decorate your shelter or speed up and expedite to your shelter. But you have to pay rent on the energy to keep that shelter secure.
Yes.
If you had cold fusion, then the money economy would diminish as a tyrannical force, as a force from the visual space state that Virilio is against. Money as a medium that rose with the ideal geometry. And we then would have an energy source where you only have to pay 10 bucks every 20 years.
But who would allow you to have? I mean, it seems
that... Let me Who would allow that to happen?
Yeah.
The service of this instantaneous tactile clone DSP environment is that nobody can control it. So there's a lot of room for decentralized action. So George Bush can conquer the Middle East, but he can't conquer China. And China and Africa, they're not organized under the industrial structures of the 20th century. They can bring in cold fusion, and nobody can stop them. They're outside the empire. So they will be the breakthrough countries, and the United States will be the last country that will use cold fusion.
Fantastic note to end on. Now that's okay. And so, yeah, just like I said before we got in the air, on the air, we'll probably get to maybe 5 or 6 pages of this, but hopefully we can pick this up in the next installment.
We're always in the middle. We attempt to have an ending at the end of an hour. We attempted to have a beginning at the beginning. But the services of this instant post-nano ecstasy we're in is it cannot be controlled by the state or the ideal geometry anymore. That's what's the good news.
Fantastic for that. Okay, everybody, let's go to Africa. All right.
Yes.
Bob, I want to thank you so much. This was an amazing hour. This was so fun. I can't wait. Would you like to continue with Virilio when we come back?
Well, we'll see what happens in a month. I mean, the Matrix is coming up. The Matrix proves my point that Robert Goffey, the famous journalist who said the Matrix 1 was about me, is going to be delighted to find out when he sees it the Matrix 2 is about me.
Yes.
Because I predicted what it would be about, which is Trinity and the Prior Scion, which was my father's roots.
So that's
pretty interesting.
So maybe next month we'll get Robert and you and I, and we will discuss that.
Yes.
Okay, fantastic.
And if he doesn't show up, we'll do Virilio.
Okay, darling, fantastic. But he probably will. All right. All right, folks, well, you heard it for the next installment, an analysis of the Matrix and that reflecting upon Bob and how that could be. So, darlings, Bob, thank you again. And all right, darlings, the fun drive is coming up next week. And so we have some really groovy thank yous, really groovy, all that. Oh, more than ever, Pacifica needs your help and your love. And so we hope that you join us here in the late night. Keep coming back and helping us bring good things to light late at night. All right. Until next week, we'll see you then.